everyone. I am Heidi.
And I'm Brittany.
And this is Transforming Together, the HopeWorks podcast.
Yes. And this month, we are transforming the way that we think and talk about sexual violence as being separate and apart from racism. Jazz fingers.
Yes. So just before we dive into this topic, this is 1 year of podcasting for us on Transforming Together. This is our 13th episode.
Yeah.
One coming out a month. It's been a really lovely, exciting journey.
Yes. Our comfort levels have grown and solidified. This time last year, my heart was pounding and racing, and I actually feel somewhat steady and calm right now.
So thanks for those of you who have been listening with us.
Yeah, thank you for having us. Yeah. We're excited to finally be tackling this topic. I think Heidi and I have been putting it off for a while, knowing that we can really go in on this as a conversation, but wanting to be really mindful about when and the language that we use and making this accessible.
It's something that we're talking about all the time. We've talked about intersections mm-hmm. on this podcast before, but the specific ways that racism and sexual violence compound another mm-hmm. is something we've been wanting to dive into. And just before we get into it, I want to put it out there and acknowledge that in prep for this podcast, my perfectionism has been rearing its ugly mm-hmm. head. And
me too.
That can be something that gets in the way of speaking freely and authentically mm-hmm. about these critical topics, because we're worried, well, I don't want to say the wrong word, or I don't want to mess it up, and just kind of acknowledging that it's very likely that we might mess up mm-hmm. today. We mess up constantly, but that's not going to stop us from trying.
yeah. Well, and this isn't like a super focused topic in the way that some of our other episodes have been, because this is more nebulous. I think we've really been worried about how to frame this, how to keep the language available and accessible to all of our listeners. So bear with us, please. And also, content warning, just because we're going to be talking about historical experiences and systems of oppression, we are going to be talking pretty explicitly about rape and genocide and kind of brutal truths of violence in our history as a country and nation.
So we're grounding ourselves today in the fact that it is Black History Month. It's Teen mm-hmm. Dating Violence Awareness Month.
Yes, it is Black Panther Month.
That's how we celebrated our 1 year of podcasting this weekend, both of us.
Watching Black Panther this past weekend.
Go
awesome
see it.
Movie. So we want to really talk about the fact that isms and systems of oppression are rooted in power and control. And we've talked about that as it relates to intimate partner and sexual violence, but really also understanding that racism and colonialism and capitalism, these broader isms are also rooted in power and control. And so when we talk about racialized sexual violence, we are talking about a system of inequality and a power imbalance.
Well, just to kind of ground this in an example, because it'd be really easy for Brittany and I to be talking about the theoretical constantly. Oh, wait, first things we were going to define what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about racialized sexual violence, what does that term racialized mean? And for us, we'll just pull the definition from the interwebs. But racialization is the process of ascribing racial identities to a relationship, social practice, or group that did not identify itself as such.
Yes.
So we'll talk more in depth about these ideas, but it's ways in which people of color and women of color and gender nonconforming people of color especially are fetishized, are
hypersexualized,
dehumanized,
commodified.
Mm-hmm. That process as tied to that sexualization mm-hmm. for us.
So, you know, it's Black History Month. It makes sense to really talk about the legacy of slavery, and not only as it relates to Black women, but primarily as it relates to Black women. So can you tell us a little bit more about that Teen Vogue article that came out last year, Heidi?
Yeah. So about a year ago, almost to the day, there was an article that came up in Teen Vogue, which is doing some really awesome reporting. If you're not looking to Teen Vogue for your social justice news yet, start doing so, because they're doing great work. Mm-hmm. But it was actually in response to a Washington Post article that was talking about renovations being done at Monticello, or restorations, I suppose, which is, Monticello is Thomas Jefferson's historical home, which is now a tourist site that you can visit in the D.C. area. And specifically talking about how in the restoration, a new room was being opened to the public, which was Sally Hemings' bedroom. And the title of their article was something along the lines of, "Public will now have access to Thomas Jefferson's mistress's bedroom." And yeah, not happy about that.
Newsflash, you cannot be a mistress and a slave at the same time.
Uh-huh. And so that is exactly what Teen Vogue and the Twitterverse were calling out. Sally Hemings was not a mistress. She was a slave and a rape victim. Mm-hmm. The term mistress implies consent. It implies mutuality. It implies choice. Mm-hmm. And if, Brittany, you put it really well earlier today, if you're someone who is threatened with beating or death or other brutalization if you don't sleep with someone, that is not a consensual relationship in the slightest, and there's no way for that to be a consensual relationship.
Mm-hmm. Because in that dichotomy, you have a slave and you have a master. And so there is no real opportunity for consent there. And basically, when we're looking at Black women as slaves, they are property. And not just Black women, right? When we're talking about Black folks as slaves, we're talking about them as property. We are talking about them as something, humans who are acquired through a transaction, through the purchase and selling of goods. And really with Black women specifically, when you have that dehumanization, when you are treating them as property, you're also treating Black women as the breeders of your workforce.
Well, Sally Hemings had at least six, I believe, of Thomas Jefferson's children. Mm-hmm. And those children were not born
free.
As free human beings. They were born being dehumanized
as property
the moment they breathed.
Mm-hmm. And so what we really want to underscore in this particular example is that if you look at the episodes where we've talked about consent, and you've talked about it being free from power imbalance and free from coercion, just by those very definitions, you cannot have a power imbalance free relationship between a slave and their master. And then there's like the flip side of that, right, with the myth of the Black rapist and how there was a particular story that was told around the purity of white women and how Black men were these kind of voracious animal-like creatures who could not be trusted near the virtue and purity of white women.
Well, there's this this idea of this animalistic sex drive that, once again, repeatedly in culture and in history, Black people are compared to animals. Mm. The hypersexual men and women, Black women also being hypersexualized.
Well, Sarji Bartman, who was from South Africa, and she was put on display, Heidi, you utilize the term human zoo, and there were these things like the World's Fair around the 1920s, 1930s, and you literally had bodies put on display so that humans could kind of gawk.
So that white people could gawk.
At the difference in bodies, and specifically with Sarji Bartman, it was her butt. And so, these are these early examples of the sexualization and commodification of human beings.
Right. And that commodification is inherently dehumanizing.
Yeah.
Part of what we're looking at is the stories that we've been told, the narratives we've been told about our history, and how in upholding what's easy or what's apologizing for behavior of people we want to uphold as heroes, mm-hmm. is covering up violence. So in the case of Thomas Jefferson, he's a founding father. He's someone we want to believe to be good, but that narrative it can't be held in exclusivity to this narrative of violence. Mm-hmm. Another narrative that I think there's beginning to be creeping more consciousness around, but still not nearly enough, mm-hmm. is around Christopher Columbus.
Yes. And the founding of our nation. Christopher Columbus, we understand. And so really quickly, I just want to say, in terms of Heidi and I and why we believe in the importance of this conversation. We talk about this in the community. I don't know if we've mentioned it as explicitly in our podcasts. I think we have the fact that Black and Brown and Native women are disproportionately impacted by sexual violence today, right? And so being really clear that we ground that awareness in this historical context. And so talking about Christopher Columbus as someone who rewarded his men with women, indigenous women, to rape, that is the counter story to the dominant story that we need to uplift, because Native women are 27%, not 27% more likely, but up to 27% of Native women are going to experience sexual violence in their lifetime.
And the majority of that sexual violence towards Native women today is still perpetrated by white men.
Yes, it's not within Native American men and women on reservations. It's folks from outside the reservation who are perpetrating that violence.
So thank you, Brittany, for that. So we're talking about history because there's a direct line through to today and continuing sexual and domestic violence. That's part of the work that HopeWorks does in the community.
And so part of why that happens is because we have exoticized and fetishized particular communities, and particularly certain communities of women. Can you share a little bit more about one of the other great myths and dominant stories of particularly our generation, our Disney fave?
Are you talking about Pocahontas, Brittany?
I might be.
Pocahontas. Okay, so I'm not going to lie. That was one of my fave Disney movies growing up. Pure fiction, mm-hmm. 100% not grounded in facts in the slightest. To start off, Pocahontas was not this young woman's real name. That was a name that was ascribed to her. Mm-hmm. Her name, and I'm not going to pronounce it well, perhaps, but Matoaka mm-hmm. was this young woman's name. And when the sexy blonde figure of John Smith came into the picture, she was 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And none of what would have happened in the Disney movie was what it looked like. That young woman was, when she was 14, married off to a different English man.
Well, and then even right here, our language, right? We're referring to her as a young woman when really she
was
a
child.
Girl.
She was a child. Thank you. Thank you for catching me. So she was married off to an English man and basically paraded around
England
and then sent back to her home. But before she could even make it on the boat back, she died of syphilis.
Right. So, and there it is. So you have the experience of sexual violence by a child, and then you have this sexualized way of dying to be killed by a sexually transmitted infection. And I just kind of want to uplift that for a second. I have mentioned in previous podcast episodes that I'm Kanaka Maoli or Native Hawaiian, and that is kind of an experience that is shared for Native peoples with Native Hawaiians upon contact. Our numbers decreased exponentially. So we went from hundreds of thousands to existing under 100,000. And this is from sexually transmitted infections that were passed on from folks who came off their boats.
And just the fact that thinking about that idea of commodification mm-hmm. and with both slavery and with the treatment of indigenous folks, ultimately at the end of the day, a lot of this sexual violence rooted still in patriarchy, rooted in racism, but also rooted in the idea of capital gain, mm-hmm. right? So raping slave women to produce more slaves, mm-hmm. raping Native women, either raping them to create a gradually more white mm-hmm. population and that cultural genocide, mm-hmm. or murdering mm-hmm. Native women so that there couldn't be any more Native peoples born to continue to pose a threat to this colonialist
capitalist
endeavor.
Acquisition of resources, acquisition of land. And so if you think of the land as a site of violence, we kind of want to shift gears for a second and talk about sexual violence amongst impoverished and undocumented folks. And specifically here, I'm thinking about domestic workers. So I'm thinking about folks who are nannies or maids or housekeepers or home health care aides, also folks within the restaurant industry. And this feels kind of timely also when we think about the hashtag MeToo conversation. And you have a lot of domestic workers who are speaking up and saying, I'm actually not represented within this conversation. And here's why I'm not represented within that conversation. It doesn't mean that you don't have white folks who are not domestic workers. It just means that there is, again, this overrepresentation of women of color in these kind of service industry fields. And there's a lot of reasons why that is. I think part of it is rooted in these are employment fields where there is a gross lack of protections regarding minimum wage, regarding time off, paid time off, unemployment benefits, guaranteed paid overtime. And so you have this representation of poor women of color in these fields or folks who can't speak English in these fields because really it's survival and tyranny of the moment. So I need to make a paycheck. I can't afford to miss a paycheck. Therefore, I'm more likely to not report.
And well, we dehumanize people in these roles.
Yes, thank you.
In similar ways to the dehumanization we were talking about before. You said it when we were discussing this earlier. There's a certain level of abuse that's almost expected mm-hmm. with these roles. It's like, well, you know, if you didn't want to get bossed around, if you didn't want to have to conform to the customer is always right, so you just better shut up and do your job. Well, then you should just get educated and get a better job.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And there's this lack of acknowledgement that no matter who's doing it, these jobs are always going to exist. And it ties into the way sexism works, right?
Yeah.
The ways in which there's an undervaluing of labor that involves caregiving or mm-hmm. or cleaning or caretaking of, mm-hmm. of the elderly or children.
Yes.
Elderly and children are not going to go away if every single person gets a college degree and can get a better job.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And so there's this undervaluing, this complicitness around this ongoing violence. And also it's so many of these jobs are ones that you work in solitarily.
Yes. Yes, thank you for saying that.
Where there's opportunities to get someone alone, if it's in the restaurant industry where there's lots of people around you, there's lots of places to get someone alone.
Storage room, like reports of folks being raped in the storage room.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's no one to really form alliance with mm-hmm. if this is going on. There's not an easy way to report violence. And if you did choose to report violence, and so many of these jobs as domestic workers, as nannies, the person you're working for, that reference is critical.
Yes, references and recommendations
mm-hmm. to get another job. And so there's kind of this implicit understanding that you'll put up with whatever abuse I'm throwing your way if you ever want to work a job again.
Yeah.
Power and control.
Yes. And again, so going back to what needs to be present for there to be consent. With looking at domestic workers and folks who are undocumented or non-English speaking, there are these very clear power imbalances that make obtaining consent, I want to say impossible.
Mm.
Yeah, I want to say impossible. I don't want to qualify that. And so here the thread that connects domestic workers and sexual violence to Native women and Black women and Brown women and sexual violence, I think really is the conversation around colonialism and capitalism and how this commodification of bodies, the sexualization of bodies, we have set things up in such a way that people are purchased. Human trafficking. Heidi, can you say a little bit about trafficking and like the difference between sex trafficking and labor trafficking?
Sure. So we want to highlight both. And we were talking about abuse that can happen within the context of paid domestic workers mm-hmm. and paid nannies. But so often these are folks who are being trafficked. And just we could do a whole other podcast explicitly about trafficking. Maybe we will sometime in the future. But people often think explicitly of sex trafficking and forced prostitution when we talk about human trafficking, which mm-hmm. is definitely present and is something that HopeWorks focused on. But trafficking is really any situation in which someone is being forced to provide labor, whether that is labor as a domestic worker or sex labor, mm-hmm. against their will. It also, you don't have to be physically moved to be trafficked. Mm-hmm. It's a slight tangent, but that's another misconception. You can be trafficked in your own home, in your own city, if there's that power and control element forcing you to do labor without compensation. So human trafficking survivors of any variety, again, women of color are extremely overrepresented in that population of folks who are trafficked.
Mm-hmm. And so like this is the thread that connects everything for us, I think, is understanding that within our reality, I think very much rooted in colonialism, you had this thing where sex is something that you could purchase, where sex is a good to be bought and sold. There is a supply and a demand. And so connecting all of these examples that we've talked about is this idea of particular communities of women being hypersexualized, exoticized. And what happens, right, when we treat someone as exotic is you create this binary between, or this dichotomy between, what is considered normal and then what is considered other or foreign, because exotic is just another way of saying foreign. And so you have, and you see this when you see the ways that Asian women are considered submissive and sexually demure, and you see this with the geisha, or when you have South Asian women who are referred to as spicy. We saw it with Aladdin and Jasmine. It's, a lot of this is in Disney movies, honestly, yeah. The ways in which we fetishize particular communities. And all of that buys into or plays into the value that we assign to the sex of particular women of color.
Yeah. And if we grant them, and we meaning society, any sexual agency, mm-hmm. Where to go with this?
Maybe there's nowhere to go with that.
Yeah.
I think just kind of landing there and really sitting with the fact that,
yeah,
we have set up a particular system that juxtaposes women of color against this idea of purity and virginity and sacredness, kind of the meaning that we've assigned to white womanhood. But understanding also that this juxtaposition and the violence of against women of color serves to reinforce violence against white women.
I think what I'm getting stuck on right now, just internally sitting here, is as we're working hard to lay this out in a clear, concise way for the sake of this podcast, but thinking about this stuff, talking about this stuff, I am not able to express in the clear, coherent way how much rage, how much rage I feel about all of this. And we can try to lay it out as clearly as we can, but it is mucky, it is entangled, it is so deeply entrenched that to even try to piece apart the ways in which white supremacy, capitalism, colonialism, patriarchy are consistently embedded to do so much violence that it becomes normalized.
And to reinforce one another such that it becomes damn near impossible to disentangle them. I think that if you could take anything away from this episode, I think what is really critical in connecting sexual violence and racism and this conversation around power and control is understanding that sexual violence within a racist system is used as a mechanism of control.
Yes.
You know, I think the gist and the point of everything that we have said here is that sexual violence is used as a means of controlling communities. A very contemporary example, if you look at the Philippine president, Rodrigo Duterte, was very recently, I want to say 2 weeks ago, speaking to a group of his forces and his directive. And he said, "We will not kill you. We will just shoot you in the vagina," as he was talking about female guerrilla fighters. And he went on to say that women without vaginas are useless. And so whether you are dying from sexually transmitted infection, whether you are dying because of a sexualized method of homicide, or through your babies being taken away, or
forced sterilization,
rape, disproportionate experience of sexual violence, it is a weapon of colonialism and domination.
And another weapon that's used alongside, that's entangled, is mass incarceration.
Yes.
Women of color, black women specifically, are the fastest growing prison population in the United States. And prisons themselves, as a site of power and control, are also so often sites of sexual violence. Mm-hmm. And so many people who are incarcerated are already survivors of sexual violence, mm-hmm. or of intimate partner violence.
Yes.
Staggering percentages, mm-hmm. of women in prison are survivors of intimate partner violence.
And then if you look at the very makeup of what it means to be incarcerated, there is such a built-in power imbalance there that private prisons become these sites, these spaces for violence to thrive and to flourish, because who's going to believe this inmate versus this prison guard? Who is going to believe this inmate versus this judge or pro bono lawyer. Whenever you have this power dynamic, it becomes incredibly difficult to speak up, because it's so much easier to say, well, no one's going to believe you.
And that's true for what we say consistently about the necessity of believing survivors. So often survivors of color are among those who are not heard, who are not believed, who are not uplifted as a key central point of the conversation.
And that's the, I think, very often uniting thread between racism and sexual violence for us, is this idea of victim blaming and not believing survivors. So we say the same thing to survivors of sexual violence that we do to folks who are sharing their experience of racism. Well, I didn't see it happen, or you're too emotional, or you're not remembering things correctly. Yeah. And so I think if you just look at like the language around the stories that we tell, you can see those connections there. But it is something that you have to do a little bit of digging and unlearning and deconditioning to really start to see for yourself.
And hopefully what you're beginning to get from this episode, and if you've been a consistent listener of the podcast, is for us at HopeWorks, the work of ending sexual violence, yes, and intimate partner violence is 100% intimately tied to ending racial violence and racism. Mm-hmm. You cannot have one without the other, because the two are so inherently linked.
Yeah.
So we're undergoing processes at our office of examining the way that racism shows up, yeah, for us, the ways in which white dominant culture and the ways that that operates within the majority of nonprofits. Mm-hmm.
And power and control elements rooted, right, in hierarchy. We are not free from the systems in which we are embedded. So capitalism, classism, these isms also show up within our own doors. And so how do we simultaneously work to see these things eradicated outside and within our own systems? We don't have an easy answer for all of this.
Well, I want to repeat that they show up in myself and in, yeah, in Brittany as well. It's really easy to feel like or sound like experts, which is a word we struggle with, talking, yeah, about all these topics. But this stuff lives in me.
Yeah,
it lives in everything that I still have yet to unlearn, that I'll be working on forever.
Yeah. And we recognize that this is one of our more challenging episodes. So if you struggle with any of these conversations or with any aspect of this conversation or talking points, please feel free to reach out to us. We are on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can email our outreach at wearehopeworks.org or info@wearehopeworks.org email accounts. We really do welcome this dialogue, because we think it's a conversation that's important to have.
And if you keep wanting to do some more research on some of the historical stuff we mentioned, there are there's a lot of great books out there. Two to really lift up are James Lowen's Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, mm-hmm, and Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States of America, really beginning to examine the ways that we were not taught the whole picture at, mm-hmm, all, and sometimes taught outright lies,
yes,
to uphold an image of what we want our country to be.
There's a lot more. And if you have any interest in books outside of that, again, please feel free to contact us. We have some new changes that we'll be announcing coming up next month. There's some shifts happening with the community engagement department, but we will leave that for you folks for next month.
In the meantime, thank you for listening. Go see Black Panther, mm-hmm, if you haven't already.
And shout out, we're less than a month away from spring. Alrighty, take care.
Take care.